You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I have with me in studio this week Shane Taylor, who's the horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. And as part of our series of looking at different houseplants, this week it's Tillandsia. And this is one I am not familiar with, so go for it.
All right. Well, Tillandsias have become very popular lately. We've got so many different ways of displaying them because Tillandsias are what they call air plants. They don't grow in soil. They grow epiphytically up in the trees. So you can do almost anything with these little plants because they're just sitting out in the open. They don't have roots that go down in the soil. You can set them in a vase. You can put them in a terrarium. You can hang them in your shower. You can set them in a bowl. You can do all sorts of different things with them. And they're becoming increasingly popular because of that versatility and the fact that they're pretty hardy little plants as well. Generally, the way that you water Tillandsias is by dunking them or spraying them. If you dunk them, you dunk them about once or twice a week. And if you spray them, you spray them about every 3 days or so.
So maybe that's why some people have them in their bathrooms, because the steam from the shower or
Yeah, in a humid environment like a bathroom, you wouldn't even have to dunk or spray them as often. It might be once a week because of all that extra humidity. They absorb the water that they need directly through their leaves. If they do have roots on the bottom, those roots are only there to anchor them onto the trees that they grow on. And so they'll grab hold of rough wood, or they'll grab hold of any kind of rough surface and hang on over time. But yeah, all of the nutrients and stuff is absorbed directly through the leaves of the plant itself.
And do they produce blossoms?
They do. Tillandsia is actually a small group in the bromeliad family. And bromeliads are pineapples. They have that colorful spike that comes up in the middle of the plant. And so like a pineapple or a bromeliad, you'll get these really colorful spike flowers that pop up in the middle of your Tillandsia every so often. It doesn't happen super often, but when it does, it's quite showy. And some of them can be really fragrant as well.
Now, with a bromeliad, once that blossoms, that particular plant itself doesn't blossom again. Does this do the same thing?
Yeah, this has the same growth habit, only because they offset so rapidly. That one that didn't bloom is going to disappear really quickly, and you're going to end up with offsets that will take its place and eventually bloom on their own. So as your clump of Tillandsia gets bigger and bigger, a more frequent flowering is possible because they can be on different time frames and you can end up with flowers throughout the year.
So these are ones that looks like you can just kind of put on different types of arrangements. I mean, you can really just kind of put them anywhere.
Yeah, we use them a lot in our arrangements that we make at Cactus and Tropicals. We'll use them with our orchid arrangements. You'll find these actually growing in the rainforest with the orchids, so their care is very similar. And it's a fun way to add some extra texture or a different type of flower to an orchid arrangement is by adding some Tillandsias. They also are fun on their own. And right now, one of the biggest trends that we're finding is people finding interesting glass containers, glass vases, adding some bark or some stones, and then displaying their Tillandsias in essentially just a small terrarium.
Hmm. And do you have to fertilize them at all?
You can. Because they are bloomers, it does help to give them some bloom fertilizer every so often. And because they absorb their nutrients through their leaves, you then have to fertilize them by spraying the fertilizer onto the plant itself or dunking it into water that has some fertilizer diluted. Of course, they are a little bit more sensitive, so you want to make sure that you either use specific Tillandsia food or you use an all-purpose fertilizer that's been diluted half or quarter strength of what it recommends.
I look at it and go, air fern. So is that kind of like a general what people would call? Do air ferns fall within this?
Air ferns, yes. Yeah, we hear people call them air ferns, air plants, all sorts of different names. Tillandsia is just the botanical name. And it refers to the entire group of them, whereas air fern can also be a dried asparagus fern, which isn't actually alive, but they look alive.
With the Tillandsia, how large will they get? Will they trail?
It depends species by species, but there are Tillandsias that will be as large as, I'd say, a specimen in the wild, a yoga ball, one of those big things that you sit on. You could see a big globe-like Tillandsia to be that size, all the way down to just the size of about a quarter, just tiny. So a lot of size variation in the Tillandsia world, a lot of leaf color variation. You'll get things from white to green to stripes, skinny leaves, thick leaves. There's many, many different variations of Tillandsias, many different species, individual species. And like so many collectible plants, they're constantly cross-pollinating and hybridizing and coming up with different color flowers and different color leaves. And it seems like every time we bring Tillandsias in, there's always something new. There always seems to be a few species that I've never even heard of. I always have to look them up and figure out what I'm looking at before we bring them in.
And so when you look at a Tillandsia, for the most part, they're fairly small. And again, they positives, they tend to go everywhere. Are there any negatives with the Tillandsia?
Tillandsias are easy to rot. So if you soak a Tillandsia, you got to shake it out because water can get down in the nooks and crannies of the leaves, and it can cause some serious problems. And it's funny, you think about that. There's nobody to shake them out in the rainforest, so what's the difference there? It's got to be whatever's in our water. But you want to thoroughly remove any excess water from the leaves because with the same thing as every other plant, the number one problem we see people have with them is they rot and they get mushy and they just fall apart. They actually are very descriptive as to what you need to do just by looking at the color. I talked about how there's a few different colors. The more white they are, the more light they need. If they're really, really white, that means they grow higher in the canopies or they grow out where they actually get some sun. And so that white coloration or the fuzz on the leaf is often to protect them from the sun. Whereas if they're dark green, they grow lower in the canopy and they're used to lower light. So you got to make sure to really look at whatever Tillandsia you've picked up and know which kind of light it is based on what color the Tillandsia is.
But with the Tillandsia, you do need to make sure that it's being watered, not once every couple of weeks, but it needs it every 2 to 3 days.
Yeah, you should check it at least every few days. I'd say at least every 3 days, check on it to see how it's doing. They'll change color when they're wet. Mm. And when you spray or soak a Tillandsia, especially if it's got that white fuzz on the leaf, it will turn dark green for just a little while. And if you see any of the plant that's still that dark, moist color when you go to water again, then wait a little bit. If not, then go ahead and give it a spritz. Of course, don't let any part of the plant stand in water at all. If you've got it in a terrarium, make sure there's no standing water at the base that would cause the stem to rot. They're fairly easy going. There's just not a whole lot you have to do with them.
Okay. We've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals, has been my guest. And this week, we were talking about Tillandsia. Shane, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Brian.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and on the line with me from Utah County is Ton Bettis. He's USU's extension horticulturist, and we're going to talk about weeds, but specifically start out talking about bindweed. Ton, how did bindweed get the name Morning Glory?
It is in the Morning Glory family and looks very similar to cultivated Morning Glories that you would run up a fence or a trellis. The cultivated Morning Glories have a lot larger flower, but otherwise they look the same. And they, as I said, are in the exact same family. But the field bindweed is a cousin to that, and it's a very noxious weed. And so just by association of the looks of the flowers, especially in the climbing nature, it's oftentimes called Morning Glory.
Yeah, but what happens below the ground is certainly a lot different.
It is. The Morning Glory that you grow on a fence or a trellis is an annual, and it dies every year when we get hard frost. It may come back from seed, but that's about it. And so if you have somewhere you don't want it, you can just hoe it out or pluck them up, transplant them. Field bindweed has underground runners, and it will run those underground runners, and those can go several feet, but it will also spread above ground through its above ground runners. So the underground ones are called rhizomes, the above ground ones are called stolons, and then it can also reproduce from seed, and the seed will last in the soil for up to 50 years.
That's 50, not 15?
Not 1550.
I say 15 is bad enough. So there's a viability in the seed up to 50 years.
Yes.
So that means that even if you start pulling it out and try to keep it continually pulled out, it may take up to 50 years before you get all of the seed out?
Correct. Correct. I just talked to a gentleman who remembers as a little kid building a barn with his dad. Then the area had field bindweed, and just they had a wooden floor and the animals and everything in there. There was no bindweed in there. Well, they recently tore the barn down because it was getting old, and within just a few months, field bindweed started to germinate in the footprint where that barn had been.
So I've recently had a part of my garden where the field bindweed was advancing from a ditch bank and came in, and I really wasn't staying on top of it as well as I should have. So I've started to attack it over the last couple of years. And for me, pulling is just not going to be enough because these roots, as you mentioned in your article, go down, what is it, up to 30 feet?
Yes.
So you can keep pulling it, and eventually, I guess, the roots lose their energy and aren't able to regenerate, but that's just going to take too long. So I thought
around 7 or 8 years on average is what it's going to take. If you let the above ground stems get about 6 inches to a foot long and then keep hoeing them out so they don't have the ability to produce seed, around 7, 8, 9 years is the average on actually controlling an infestation.
Sounds like a good kid project.
Yes. And when the kids aren't behaving, I'll make you pull field bindweed.
So you say they have to get at least 6 inches long? Before you
want to let
them
produce a little bit. You know, you can keep them constantly hoed out when they're smaller, but you have to do it by the time they're between 6 inches, a foot max. By the time those are a foot long, they start to produce flowers and have the potential to produce seed again, and then they're gathering quite a bit of energy from the sun.
And then they're taking that energy and storing it in the roots?
They are.
All right, so this is a good time of year, though, to be able to take advantage of what they're doing by pulling that energy down into the roots. So if you want to go into the, get away from organic and try to take care of this a little bit quicker, there are several different methods that can be done, and one of those would be to spray the roots. Now, I've had people tell me, oh, I've tried using glyphosate, which is the Roundup, and it hasn't worked. And I'll say, well, what time of year did you put it on? Well, in the summer. Well, that's why it didn't work. So fall
during the summer and spring, all that energy production is going into propagating, spreading the plant. In the winter, any energy production and all the nutrients in those above ground stems, because they'll die back, are being pulled down into the roots. And so the autumn, especially around the time we're regularly in the 30s, which Cache Valley is right now, and the Wasatch Front will be very soon, is a great time to spray.
What do you put on them? I'm really concerned about chemicals that can translocate in the soil, which is one of the reasons why I've liked using the glyphosate, is because it does not move as readily through the soil, or at least it doesn't stay in the soil as long.
Correct. You usually have a week to 2 weeks before you can replant after spraying a glyphosate product. The next least harmful soil product would be the simple lawn weed killers, which have 2,4-D as an active ingredient. Now, I'm not saying people need to. If they choose not to, we can discuss some other things they might be able to do, but if they choose to spray, then a mix of in garden areas, especially once you have your perennials put to bed, the annuals put up, your vegetables are harvested, then the fall is a great time to do this. And you can actually spray glyphosate and a lawn weed killer together, and you'll get a synergistic effect that will further damage that field bindweed. It won't completely control it, but instead of, say, spraying Roundup alone and getting a 10 or a 15% kill, if you mix that with a lawnweed killer, then you might get a 50% kill, which when you're talking about field bindweed is excellent, and then you would spray again for 3 or 4 years after that to really start to get after it.
So when you say a 50% kill, it's killing all of the roots all the way down?
Well, of the plants that exist in that area that was sprayed, 50% of them will die. 50% will not. And so during the summer, you will have to cultivate a little bit and do what you can to keep it at bay and then spray again the next fall. But you can expect around a 50% reduction if you spray at the right time of the year with a mix of glyphosate and the Weed Be Gone type product.
Would you just mix the two together at the rates that it says on the label?
Yes, at the labeled rate. So you would get a gallon of water and then put the recommended amount of each into that gallon of water. Now, I do have to caution that more is not better in this situation, especially because there has been extensive testing performed by the companies that make these products, and they recommend these rates for very good reasons. And if you say, oh, if 1 ounce is good, 2 ounces are better, what you're going to do is scorch the top off the plant, and you will never get that chemical to translocate into the roots. And so the recommended rate is always the rate you go with, not only because it's federal law, but you're going to get the best kill at that rate.
It's one thing I've been concerned with weed killers that tend to work fairly quickly. I know with the glyphosate, it may be a couple of weeks before you see things happening, but when I, for instance, used, I think it was Weed Free Zone, you start seeing it die back within just a couple of days.
Within a few hours, and that yeah. is especially important because Weed Free Zone is one that you can use in your lawn or your garden area once the weeds are, your vegetables are out, but you especially do not want to overapply that because there are products in there that carfentrazone is the active ingredient in the weed-free zone, and if you overapply that, you pretty much just scorch the top off. I know that our weed specialists on campus, Corey Ransom, Ralph Whitesides, have both expressed concern about that exact same thing, but with the cooler weather, that's not as likely, even though you will see things wilt down more quickly in the cooler weather. It's not as likely as if you're spraying them in, say, 80 or 85 degree weather.
Another thing for consideration, depending on the product, is also the temperature when you spray it. Some of these work okay at lower temperatures, but others need higher temperatures.
They do. And I don't want to get too much into the chemistry of these, but as long as we're in the 70s during the day, then a general lawnweed killer or glyphosate will be fine. If it gets cooler, then the product we were discussing, like Weed Free Zone, there's a product called Speed Zone, which is the exact same thing. It's a little bit more concentrated. And another one called 4-Speed XT. They're all produced by different companies but have similar formulations. These are active into the 50s. And because they're ester formulations instead of being the amine, which the amines are actually honestly are safer, but these ester formulations can be used in cooler temperatures.
If you're wanting to get rid of something like wild violets, I have a ton of those on my front lawn I'm going to go after, and a product that I found that seemed to work pretty well, I'd spray in the fall and then spray again in the spring, has triclopyr in it.
Yes, Turf Lawn Ester is a common brand name that contains the triclopyr in it. The 4-Speed XT also has some 2,4-D and some other things in there. It has triclopyr, and so if you're going more for a broad spectrum, a little bit quicker kill, that's another one besides the Turf Lawn Ester that does a really good job against that perennial violet. The perennial violet was used as a ground cover in the back 20, 30, 40 years ago, and now, you know, it's not commonly used now, but everywhere it was planted, it can be extremely difficult to control.
Looking at the bindweed and trying to get rid of it the most, if you don't want to use a chemical, what else can you do besides just pulling it?
in the spring, this would be a little more effective. There's a couple of different things you can do. One of them is just to cover it. So you'd either get some construction plastic or cardboard. I know a lot of my master gardeners up in Cache Valley made friends with the bike shop owners and would get the big bike boxes. And they would put that down and then peg it down with landscape staples. They just are they're a 6-inch wire staple that you can shove into the ground. And then they'd put 3 or 4 inches of mulch on top of it that they would either make or just get from the landfill or wherever and leave it there. And then they would rake it back and swap out the cardboard once a year. And after 3 or 4 or 5 years, just because you're covering the soil, that seemed to be a pretty good method of controlling it in a pesticide free way. The other one, and this one isn't more for Cache Valley, it's just not quite warm enough, but on the Wasatch Front and in other warmer areas of Utah, you can actually cover those areas with clear plastic and solarize, and you'd put that down in mid-May and leave it until October, and that'll cook the soil about 6 inches down. If you leave that there, the field bindweed could root back up through, but over a period of doing that for 2 or 3 years, that also can be effective.
Mm. So how many years do you need to leave that on?
Because the field bindweed is so deeply rooted, 1 year is just not going to do it. You would kill the seeds, and you would kill a lot of the roots from that general spot, but because those deep roots can be down there, I just don't trust 1 year being effective. And so I would say a minimum of 3 years, and this is just more the gospel of Ton here, but a minimum of 3 years, maybe up to 5. Now, if you couldn't leave it that long, 1 year would at least knock it back quite extensively so that going forward, you could at least hand pull and do a few other things to get ahead of it.
I appreciate your help today, and thank you for joining us on Zesty Garden.
You're welcome. Anytime.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Ton Bettis is USU's Extension Horticulturist in Utah County, and we've been talking about weed control and especially field bindweed. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with our next segment, Going Native. So stay tuned. This is The Zesty Garden, and it's our segment known as Going Native, where we talk about desirable native and drought-tolerant plants that you should consider to put into your own garden. And this week, it's the Southwestern White Pine. And in with me in the studio is Jeanette Warner. She is owner of Wildland Nursery in Joseph, which is just south of Richfield. And Jeanette, Southwestern White Pine, why this one?
It's another plant that would work really well, that does work well in gardens, but it's rarely used here.
Why is that?
Because people don't know about it. I sold it for quite a few years, and all of a sudden David Salmon at High Country Gardens started advertising it for sale in his catalog. And I thought, good for you.
Good. Now it's getting a little more widely known.
A little bit more known, yes.
And how tall is it? When I think pine, you know, it's going to be fairly tall.
What I like it is it's very light and airy, 40 feet tall, and that's not too tall for a home garden. The needles come in bundles of 5 and very long, soft, and just like light and airy.
And it's columnar shaped.
Yes, not as columnar as some trees, as some pines. Like there's a really popular tree is the Pinus flexilis, the limber pine. And this is actually a cousin or a relative of the limber pine. It's the southern version of a limber pine. And it's a white pine, and there's an eastern white pine, a western white pine, and everybody knows about those, but they don't know about this southwestern pine.
So if I've got a Vanderwerf pine, but it's only a couple of years old, should I take it out and put this one in?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, really?
No, never, never. You know, you don't want to do that.
Well, I can always move it. But
no. The Vanderwolf is just too perfect. To me, it's a boring tree. Sorry. Because it's so overused, and it's overused in a lot of the wrong places.
Okay.
So like on freeway entrances. I see Vanderwolf, and it's because it's, you know, a popular tree, and that they won't live there for very long.
How quickly does this southwestern white pine grow? Okay, is it the same habit as the Vanderwolf?
Yes, it's a slow growing, but I've noticed that once mine has become established, and once they become established and get their roots out, then they're going to grow more. The new candles will eventually get like 12 inches a year.
Okay, and so explain what the candles are on a pine.
That is the new needles. Every year, the pine trees put out the new needles. And when they first growing, before the needles really put on length, they look like a candle.
And with this particular one, what color are the needles?
It's just the brightest green, the brightest green. And next to my other evergreens in my yard, it really stands out because of that bright green.
So it's drought tolerant once established. It does say you've got water in the winter.
Yes. Well, all pines need to be watered in the wintertime.
So what happens when the ground's frozen?
If you haven't received enough snow. Where I live, we do not get any snow. This last winter, when it was so cold, so early, and so dry, I'd say a good portion of the pine trees really suffered.
So maybe for areas like in Logan, where you can get snow sitting on the ground for a very long time, it's not quite of an issue.
It's not quite as critical, especially if you have a lot of moisture in the fall.
You're bringing something up here that I think is really important to point out. It's an evergreen.
Yes.
Which means it's still respirating.
That's
even
right.
Even through the winter, it slows down, but it's still drawing up moisture into those needles. So especially if you have a dry fall, that can be an issue in the winter.
And so I think the trick is, which I did, was every fall I water really, really good and deep and thoroughly.
How many years would it take to get cones on the tree? I guess it depends on how large you buy it.
But that's how old it is, right. Probably 8 to 10 years, I would think. I've had mine for 10 years, and I haven't had cones on it yet.
And the cones are 6 to 10 inches in length, cylindrical and ornamental. You've got the scales are very long with thin, narrow tip that spreads out and curves back. And the bark. Oh, okay, let's talk about the bark.
The bark is always interesting on all trees, and I think it's one of the features of a tree, besides the leaf and the color of the leaves, is the bark. I always like to touch the bark.
And it tolerates the alkaline soil.
That's the advantage coming from the southwest, where there's not as much rainfall. The soil is more alkaline. And that, I think, is the limiting factor around here why some trees don't do well.
Just too alkaline.
Mm-hmm. But they do well.
And some of the trees in the mountains, I mean, the soil in the mountains is less alkaline than it is in the valleys.
Because they get more moisture and because there's all the organic material that falls on the floor that decomposes.
And so that's why some trees just don't do so well down here. Okay, so this one is the southwestern white pine. And what zones is it good to grow in?
Zone four. It does grow in the higher elevations in the mountains, just like the limber pine grows at high elevations. But it grows further south.
Okay, so this has a wider range than a lot of the plants that we've talked about in this program. So it could be good pretty much, would you say, all over the state?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Would it be good into St. George?
I think so.
Try it, yes.
And
see what happens.
The first southwestern white pine that I bought and sold were actually grown in Idaho. And I am seeing more pines, southwestern white pines, on availability list now than I ever did before.
Good. Well, this is one to especially consider when you're looking for a tree to grow in your landscape. It doesn't get too large, up to 40 feet tall, but it's the southwestern white pine. Jeanette, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to the Going Native segment of The Zesty Garden. Jeanette Warner is owner of Wildland Nursery in Joseph, which is just south of Richfield. Coming up next is a conversation with Adri Roberts from Utah State University on how to best freeze your fruits and vegetables. This is The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And in today's Yes, You Can segment, I'm talking with Adri Roberts, Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent, and we're going to talk about freezing vegetables and fruits. Now, for me, for my garden, I prefer frozen vegetables versus bottled because they just seem to be a little bit more fresh. But there are some things that you need to do in order to keep them a little bit fresher longer. For instance, we found in the bottom of the freezer this little stash of corn, and we thought we were out, but it had been in there so long by the time we got to it, it was freezer burned.
Kind of icky, huh?
It worked to add it into a stew. Uh-huh. So it was still usable, but uh-huh. to just have it fresh wasn't very good. So what should someone consider when they're freezing fruits and vegetables? And are they different? Should they be handled different?
Most vegetables need to be blanched. And that's basically the process of putting them into boiling water, leaving them for a certain amount of time. And that varies between vegetables, pulling them out, dipping them into ice water, then draining them, and then packing them either into a Ziploc bag, freezer bag, a container of some sort. Most fruits do not have to be blanched. And
so what is that blanching process doing? Why do they have to be blanched?
They're just kind of slowing down the enzyme process and make them so that they store better, last longer in the freezer. For example, corn, though, it also sets the milk in the corn so that it will freeze better and last longer. So there's just various reasons why they highly recommend that you do that. It just kind of sets it so that it survives the freezing process.
So if you don't, you might have corn for a couple of weeks or so, but then it just quickly goes downhill.
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about the different methods of freezing? So can you just put it in a half-gallon plastic bag and call it good, or do you need to do something else?
For the vegetables?
For like vegetables.
Vegetables, mm-hmm. That's fine. You can, you know, after you've blanched it and drained it and it's fairly dry, so you don't have freezer burn. If you leave a lot of moisture on, you're going to have freezer burn. But you can just put it in a freezer bag and put it in the freezer. It works really well.
What we've tried to do, and I don't even know if maybe this is something that got handed down from mother, and it's like the pot roast with the ends cut off. You don't know why it's done. That's just what your mom did. We like to take, for corn, for instance, and lay it out on a jelly roll pan, mm-hmm. so it's in one layer, and then put it in the freezer, and kind of like, it's not a flash freezing, but freeze it just enough so then we can quickly scoop it together and pack it into a bag, because if we do it while it's too wet, it's going to be one solid chunk. Is that okay to do that?
Oh, yeah, sure. That's great. Another thing that works really well that way, too, is tomatoes don't freeze necessarily really well, but we also skin them and then lay them out on a cookie sheet individually, and then when they're good and frozen, then we'll gather them up and put them in a Ziploc bag.
Okay.
Then you can break them off and add them to spaghetti sauce or soup. They don't work well like to slice up after that and put on a sandwich, but they'd work great in one of those hotter items, casseroles and things like that.
What about the newfangled machines? Well, newfangled, they've been around for like 20 years. The ones that have, they suck the air out. I can't remember what they're called, but you have a little bar that you press down and it heat seals the end. And when you go in to get these packages, the refills, they're like really expensive.
Right.
Do they really work? And do you need to pull out all of the air?
Well, it's good. It's good to kind of maneuver it so you're pushing the air out before you seal that, you know, that bag, but it's not necessary. People who have those types of freezer gadgets seem to really like them, but I don't feel like they're absolutely
worth
necessary.
The money.
Not for me, but you know, I don't want to badmouth them too much because I know they're really liked. So,
but it's good to know you can freeze without them. They're
right.
Just fine.
The thing I like about freezing is I have a lot of people who want to use recipes that are not necessarily tested recipes by the USDA or BAL, and they can freeze anything. You can do anything you want and freeze it. So you can make up that spaghetti sauce that's a hand-me-down for generations that has not been tested by the USDA. Go ahead and make it up and freeze it, and you're fine. So people are always thrilled to hear that because they like their recipes.
For grandma's recipe.
You can freeze it. So.
So what items don't freeze very well? Anything?
Things like Lettuce and kale and...
So something with the high water content.
Right, right. Zucchini does better grated rather than sliced. Yeah, the higher water content vegetables don't do as well.
I seem to be... We do okay with the peppers, but it's something that I remember when we last did them, I wished we had actually taken the peel off.
Oh.
And because it, I don't know, it seemed to kind of separate. So maybe it was something we did that was wrong. Because normally, can you leave the peel on?
I think you can, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about fruit. Anything special with fruit?
Oh, I love fruits because so many of us are making smoothies now. And I have learned to thoroughly appreciate Brigham City peaches, but they are very expensive, and so I want to get the most for out of them. So I basically just put a small amount of sugar in a bowl and a little bit of fruit fresh. You can use citric acid or whatever. Just slice those peaches into that sugar and stir it up. The juices will come out, and you'll have this gorgeous orange liquid. And then I just put them into sandwich bags that are long and narrow. I'll kind of squish them down so they're probably about 3/4 to a cup of peaches. Wrap that sandwich bag around that little log of peaches and then put them into a quart-sized freezer bag. And then as I need them for smoothies, I just pull them out and wrap it, put it right into my blender, and it works really, really well. So there's some fun things that you can do with freezing fruit.
And with jams, for instance, For those people who don't like a lot of sugar, what alternatives do you have? Because I know my wife tried to cut down on the sugar, and it was like brick hard.
Right.
And we had to just eat it like fresh jam and leave it in the fridge because it was too hard to chisel out.
Well, that's too bad. Just make sure if you're using the low sugar type recipes that you're using the low sugar pectin. Those pectin recipes are just right to the nth degree. You can't add more fruit, you can't take away sugar, whatever. So if you are playing into that and want less sugar, then make sure you also match up that low sugar pectin. And if you like them, they seem to be turning out. A few years ago, a lot of people called and said they weren't setting up, but I haven't had those calls recently, so they must have improved them, so they're better quality pectins.
And as far as the types of fruits that work the best, I have a hard time thinking you can freeze a pear, but if you're just putting it in a smoothie, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference, is
right,
it?
Right.
So yeah, I guess it depends on what you're going to use it for.
Right.
Okay.
And the pear would be fine. Just slice it up and have it ready in the peach log, similar to what I do with my peaches. But for a smoothie, it would be fine. I don't know that you'd want it for a gourmet dish because they don't hold up quite as well as the peaches do. But
is there a recipe or something that you've tried that's a little bit different that maybe people should consider?
For freezing?
Mm-hmm.
We have a recipe in our office that one of our volunteers came in and demonstrated a few years ago that is for a peach pie filling, that you basically fill a pie tin with this concoction that she's made up with tapioca. And remember, we're freezing, so we can do anything we want. It has tapioca and a little sugar and things like that. She freezes it in a pie pan. After it's frozen, she bumps it out, knocks it out of the pan, and puts it in a gallon-sized Ziploc. And then when it's Thanksgiving time or when she wants a peach pie for Sunday dinner or whatever, she just pulls these out that she's stacked in her fridge, puts it in a pie crust that she's just made, and then bakes it, and it works
and
really
voila,
well.
It's all done.
Right, right. Oh, so that's probably the most unique thing that I have seen that works really well.
Great.
Apples would work that way, too. You could make your apple pie filling. So
I'm thinking this blackberry pie my wife made, and I just adore blackberry pie, but I wonder if this same method would work, and then I could keep it for like the midwinter when I really want to have something zesty. It sounds like it would probably work.
I think it sounds like it would be great.
Great idea.
Okay. I just think it's great, though, that some of us who don't get really excited about canning for 3 or 4 months can just quickly put some things together and throw them in the freezer, and it's not quite as labor-intensive. It cuts out several steps, so it's something you might want to consider as an alternative to canning.
Great. Well, you've been listening to Yes, You Can. Adri Roberts is Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent, and we've been talking about freezing vegetables and fruits. Thanks for coming in.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next on Petals and Prose, book lover and former English teacher Helen Cannon of Logan reads how victory gardens on the home front were crucial to the war efforts in World War II.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. And I've been thinking a lot lately, maybe because of upcoming Veterans Day, or who knows why I've thought about this, about victory gardens. I was maybe 6 or 7 when the Second World War ended, but I do remember the rationing, the encouragement to grow our own food. I could remember the tickets that Mother had to get certain groceries that were limited. So it's a subject that I find very interesting. This will be drawing upon a book by Ursula Buchan called A Green and Pleasant Land, How England's Gardeners Fought the Second World War. So I'll do some reading and commenting using this book and a few other things, as I usually do. She begins by saying, "War is the normal occupation of man. War and gardening," Winston Churchill told the poet Siegfried Sassoon in 1918. This provocative remark contains more truth than you might first think. War and gardening are what people have done since the earliest times. These occupations are truly antithetical, the one profoundly disruptive, uncivilized, and ugly, the other constructive, orderly, civilized, and both useful and capable of promoting beauty. Between 1939 and 1945 in Britain, war and gardening were very different colored strands of national life, which surprisingly often became entwined. As it turned out, gardening proved to be the one way that civilians, as well as service personnel and prisoners of war, mitigated the shots and the griefs, as well as food shortages they were forced to endure. Gardening also served as a reminder to Britons, at times comforting, at others invigorating, that their green and pleasant land, as well as more innocent and insular pursuits, was worth fighting and dying for. I think that the land came to be, in terms of a figure of speech, metonymy, where one thing stands for the whole. You might say, all hands on deck. And of course, it isn't just all hands, it means all of the sailors on deck. And so I think the land for the Britons had a larger meaning. And of course, their situation was different from ours in terms of victory gardens, because their land was being bombed and ours was not, though our soldiers were fighting for the just cause. Over time, the soil has developed a symbolic meaning and acquired a resonance far removed from the dirt in the garden or field. The soil equates to the country itself. We use the words interchangeably. In the mid-20th century, people were proud of the fact that there had been no fighting in British soil since the Battle of Culloden in 1746 and no successful foreign invasion since 1066. Despite so many changes and convulsions in the first decades of the 20th century, they retained their highly romantic view of the countryside and their nostalgia for a past rural innocence, which had been fostered by 19th and 20th century romantic writers, artists, and composers. The land, especially the countryside, was sacrosanct, inviolable, and infinitely precious. As I said, it would have been, in terms of figures of speech, metonymy. She goes on to say, "Only in the gardening sphere can I discern an unbroken thread stretching back to the 1940s and truly empathize with all the difficulties gardeners experienced in dealing with slugs or providing palatable vegetables for the kitchen in early spring, and a pleasure in a blousy dahlia flower, an apple tree blossom, a ripe greengage, or the larder shelf of bottled tomatoes. Like them, I can appreciate the way that gardening offers the possibility of putting away past failures as one season ends and another beckons. The fact that there is always next year, it is in the garden that I most closely connect with those who went before me, since the essence of the garden is timeless." And thinking about Britain and the bombing and the terror they must have felt, I ran across an essay by Virginia Woolf. The New Republic magazine is celebrating its 100th year, and I hadn't realized that Virginia Woolf, even though I have her 6 volumes of collected essays, I hadn't realized that Virginia Woolf had published this essay, Thoughts on Peace in an Air Raid in the New Republic. Virginia Woolf's war years swung widely between bouts of defiance and depression. She made a pact with her husband, Leonard, that if the Nazis prevailed, they would close the door to their garage, turn the car's ignition, and inhale the fumes to evade the indignity of surrendering to fascism. A month after she wrote this piece, bombs flattened her home and office. 5 months later, she did, in fact, kill herself. So this is part of her essay. The Germans were over this house last night and the night before that. Here they are again. It's a queer experience, lying in the dark and listening to the zoom of a hornet, which may at any moment sting you to death. It is a sound that it interrupts cool and consecutive thinking about peace. Yet it is a sound far more than prayers and anthems that should compel one to think about peace. Unless we can think peace into existence, we, not this one body in this one bed, but millions of bodies yet to be born, will lie in the same darkness and hear the same death rattle overhead. Let us think what we can do to create the only efficient air raid shelter while the guns on the hilltop go pop, 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 and the searchlights finger the clouds, and now and then, sometimes close at hand, sometimes far away, bombs drop. Up there in the sky, young Englishmen and young German men are fighting each other. The defenders are men, the attackers are men. Arms are not given to the English women, either to fight the enemy or to defend itself. She must lie in weaponless tonight. But there is another way of fighting for freedom without arms. We can fight with the mind. We can make ideas that will help young Englishmen, the young Englishman who is fighting up in the sky to defeat the enemy. A bomb drops, all the windows rattle. Hitlers are bred by slaves. A bomb drops, all the windows rattle, the anti-aircraft guns are getting active. Up there on the hill, under a net tagged with strips of green and brown stuff to imitate the hues of autumn leaves, guns are concealed. Now they all fire at once. On the 9 o'clock radio, we shall be told, 44 enemy planes were shot down during the night. 10 of them by anti-aircraft fire, and one of the terms of peace, the loudspeakers say, is to be disarmament. The searchlights wavering across the flat have picked up the plane now. From this window, we can see one little silver insect turning and twisting in the light. The guns go pop, 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 then they cease. Probably the raider was brought down behind the hill. One of the pilots landed safe in a field near here the other day. He said to his captors, speaking fairly good English, "How glad I am that the fight is over." Then an Englishman gave him a cigarette, and an Englishwoman made him a cup of tea. That would seem to show that if you can free the man from the machine, the seed does not fall upon altogether stony ground. The seed may be fertile. I look forward to talking with you again. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.